Well, first of all, I want to thank Jerry Newcomb and Kirsty for hosting me at their home. And Jerry's such a great friend. There's probably not anybody else in the country or the world that I have a kindred spirit with more than Jerry Newcomb. When we get together, we're like instantly into the history level. You know, forget all the small talk. Let's just get into. And Dr. D. James Kennedy made a tremendous impact on my life. He was one of the first ones to have me on national radio when I came out with my first book, America's God and Country. And then since then, have had the privilege of speaking at Reclaiming America for Christ conferences and then being in the different specials that are produced through D. James Kennedy Ministry. So thank you, Jerry, and thank you, everyone at New Presbyterian Church and Jim Carlson and the whole family. I do want to mention a couple new books since the last time I was here. One is called Rise of the Tyrant, and I'm going to be talking about my subject matter today is from a lot of that. Another is called For God and Country that was produced through the Center for Christian Statesmanship. And John Sorensen and John Hosteller, a former congressman from Indiana. And then a DVD called Change to Chains, a little play on words there. And it goes through a lot of the talk that I'm talking about today just in DVD form. And with that, let me jump in. And Ronald Reagan said in 1961, "In this country of ours took place the greatest revolution that has ever taken place in the world's history. Every other revolution simply exchanged one set of rulers for another. Here, for the first time in all the thousands of years of man's relation to man, the founding fathers established the idea that you and I had within ourselves the God-given right and ability to determine our own destiny." Everybody say that. The God-given right and ability to determine our own destiny. You know, having the God-given right and ability to determine our own destiny, deciding what to do with your life, is a luxury which most people through the world history have not had. You can determine what you want to eat, how you want to dress, where you want to live, who to marry, what to believe, what career to have, what business to start, what church to attend, what dreams to pursue. Here, Chief Justice John Jay said, "Americans are the first people whom heaven has favored with an opportunity of choosing the forms of government under which they should live. All other constitutions have derived their existence from violence or accidental circumstances." He goes on, "Your lives, your liberties, your property will be at the disposal only of your Creator and yourselves. You get to decide what you are going to do with your life. It's just your own determination, your own creativity, your own hard work, your own studying that determines it. There's no government structure. There's no politics." Here's a General Bob Stewart. And I met him when I spoke at a convention in the Space Coast of Florida. And he was an astronaut. He was in the Challenger's last, and then in the Atlantis. And so we're going through the Kennedy Space Center, and we see the Atlantis hanging there. And he says, "The last time I saw that, I was on it." But here, he had a dream to be an astronaut, and he got to be one. Do you know everything you see was once an idea in somebody's head? Right? Look around the room. The building. Somebody thought of this building. Somebody thought, designed that fan, gave it to a manufacturer, say, make it. Somebody designed that speaker. Right? They sketched it out, gave it to a sound engineer, said, make me something like that. Somebody designed the chair you're sitting in. They sketched it out, gave it to somebody, say, make this. Somebody designed the clothes that you're wearing. They drew it out, gave it to a seamstress, say, make me something like this. Somebody thought of the glasses you're wearing, the jewelry, the pen, the iPhone. Everything was once just a thought in somebody's head. And they worked with that thought, and they brought it from the thought realm into the reality realm. You get to pursue your dreams in America, where in other countries, you're not. You come up with a thought and an invention, it's immediately stolen and taken by the government. And so books and songs were once ideas. Businesses, ministries, once an idea. Dr. Kennedy had the idea for the Coral Ridge and buildings, inventions, financial tools, you know, ways to make money that way, communications, real estate projects, everything, computer programs and apps. The space shuttle was once an idea, and he goes through all of the different testings and the new materials they had to develop to make it happen. And Thomas Edison said, "Genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration." So God gives the thought, but you put in the hard work. Well, you can have a victimhood mentality or the idea that ideas can make things better. So some people are brought up in a school system or in a community that says, oh, you're a victim. You need somebody to take care of you. You need somebody to give you money and feed you and everything. And the other side says, no, I can get the answers to all the problems. I can come up with inventions. I can be the answer. Anyway, everyone needs to ask the Lord to give you an idea of what he wants you to do. Now, with that setting, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Arthur Schlesinger was on John F. Kennedy's staff. He said, history is to the nation as memory is to the individual. Have you ever met an individual who has lost their memory? Maybe they have Alzheimer's. They forgot who they are. They forgot who you are. They can be taken advantage of pretty easily. Well, guess what? In America, we have national Alzheimer's. Here we are, the freest and most prosperous country with more individual liberty and opportunity where you can pursue your dreams. Here we have it, and we forgot how we got here. And as a result, we're letting it slip through our fingers like sand. We're letting it be taken away from us. So America's lost our memory. Is it on accident or is it on purpose? Do you know there's a communist tactic called deconstruction, where you separate people from their past, get them into a neutral where they don't know where they came from, and then you can brainwash them into the future you have planned for them. It's a sales technique. If I was a toothpaste salesman, the first thing I would do is say negative things about the toothpaste you are currently using. You're using that old stuff? It'll eat the enamel off your teeth. Ooh, you're repulsed by it. Now I have you into a neutral. You're sort of open-minded. What are all the toothpastes out there nowadays? And then I can give you my pitch for this new tartar-controlled breath freshener stuff, right? And so they apply this culturally. And they go into the classrooms and they tell the students, oh, the founding fathers took land from Indians and they sold people into slavery and they were chauvinists. And ooh, the students are repulsed by them. Now you got the students into a neutral. They're sort of open-minded. What are all the different belief systems out there nowadays? And then you can give them your pitch for socialism or the LGBT agenda or Islam's great, right? We see this happen in Europe. Europe went from a Judeo-Christian past into a free sex, anything goes neutral, and now it's going into an Islamic future. What do I mean? Right, Europe used to all be Catholic, and then a Protestant Reformation, and a Jewish neighborhood scattered around, so it was Judeo-Christian. But then Europe went into a secular neutral with the French Revolution. And Robespierre put a prostitute in Notre Dame Cathedral, covered her with a sheet, and said, this is the goddess of reason, let's worship her. They turned churches into temples of reason. They didn't want a seven-day week with a Sabbath rest, because that goes back to the Bible. They came up with a 10-day week, a decade week. And they didn't want done in the year of the Lord, so they made 1792, the new year, one. They wanted to totally remove all Christian influence from France. Well, they did. And then Napoleon spread this French secularism all around Europe, and Europe became secular. And hey, all belief systems are okay. Bring in whatever you want. And so into Europe comes all this free sex, the gay agenda, and now Islam. And they're taking over neighborhoods. And they're having five kids per family. And their number one name given to newborns in London, Milan, and Brussels is Mohammed. And now they're raping women in the streets of Cologne, Germany, and in Sweden, and Norway, and Denmark. And the Europeans are scratching their heads thinking, how did we get here? Easy. You went from a Judeo-Christian past into a secular, free sex, gay neutral, and now you're going into an Islamic future. So the whole gay agenda is simply a transition phase from the Judeo-Christian past before it's quickly taken over and turns into a Muslim future. Are you still with me? So we need to get our memory back to see how rare America is. Do you know there's approximately 6,000 years of recorded human history? That's all. Writing was invented around 3 or 4,000 B.C. Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. Take a piece of clay, take a stick, poke in it, and that was the beginning of writing, right? And so have you ever tallied? You know where you do the lines? One, two, three, four, then a line across the front. It was an accounting method to keep track of everything the kings had. And then it kept track of the king's decrees and then some astrology and some genealogies. But it was just for kings. Anyway, Egypt invented their hieroglyphs around 3000 B.C. China invented their pictogram characters on the bamboo annals around 2600 B.C. But if you round it out, 3 or 4,000 B.C., and we're around 2,000 A.D., that's around 5 or 6,000 years of recorded human history. Human beings writing down human records. Sort of coincidentally, that's about as long as the Bible says man's been around. But here's Franklin D. Roosevelt said, 5,000 years of recorded history have proven that mankind has always believed in God in spite of the many abortive attempts to exile God. He mentions 5,000 years. Richard Overy, editor of The Times Complete History of the World, wrote, "No date appears before the start of human civilizations around 5,500 years ago and the beginning of a written or pictorial history." Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan stated, 6,000 years of recorded history, and yet we know no more about the secret of life than they knew in the beginning. Here's Daniel Webster. He said, "Miracles do not cluster, and what has happened once in 6,000 years may not happen again. Hold on to the Constitution, for if the American Constitution should fail, there will be anarchy throughout the world." They thought something really unique happened in America in this 6,000 years of recorded human history. Justice James Wilson signed the Declaration and the Constitution and was put on the Supreme Court by George Washington, pretty smart guy. He said, "After a period of 6,000 years since creation, the United States exhibit to the world the first instance of a nation assembling voluntarily and deciding that system of government under which they should live." So 6,000 years is not that long. It's only 60 people living 100 years each back to back. How many of you have met someone who's lived 100 years? Maybe a grandmother or close to it anyway? We're talking 60 grandmothers, and you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. Right? So there's more than 60 people in this room. Every one of you pick a century, right? And that's all there is of recorded human history. But in the 6,000 years of records, what do the records show? There's this quest to rule, a quest for power. And so the most common form of government in world history is what? Well, let's see. From the very beginning, you got Cain killing Abel, and then Nimrod setting up his Tower of Babel, and then you see power wants to concentrate into the hands of one person. And so you have 2,000 years and 33 major Egyptian dynasties ruled by pharaohs, and Sargon of Akkadia, and Sennacherib of Assyria, and Cyrus of Persia, and Alexander the Great, and the Roman emperors, and the Byzantine emperors, and 5,000 years and 18 major Chinese dynasties ruled by emperors, and Attila the Hun, and Genghis Khan, and Louis the 14th, and Muslim sultans, that the records show that power gravitates into the hands of one person. It's like there's this continual effort to want to rebuild the Tower of Babel. It's like every generation wants to rebuild the Tower of Babel. There's always some Nimrod, right? Somebody that, and in that sense, death is a blessing. You think death is a blessing? Yeah, at least the dictator dies and everybody gets a little breather. And then the devil has to go back and find some other selfish person that he can use to get power reconcentrated, right? Sort of like the movie The Terminator with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Have you ever seen that? And there's this one scene where this, you know, killer monster robot from the future is chasing them, and they blow it up. And everybody in the audience sighs relief. Ah, and then these little metal pieces begin to melt into little silvery balls. And then they begin to roll together into the silvery pool. And then out of the silvery pool starts coming the hand of the Terminator. And then the whole thing comes out and starts chasing him again. You're like, ah, how do you get rid of this? It's like God at the Tower of Babel confused the languages and they all scattered. Right? But every generation, it wants to roll together again and it wants to come back. Ah, how do you get rid of this thing? And ultimately, you know, the book of Revelation says there'll be the, you know, Babylon, you know, it's going to be destroyed. Well, power wants to concentrate. It's just pull of a magnet. It's like a law of gravity. It's a pecking order. It's just in the human DNA. And the movie The Lord of the Rings has a line where Gandalf tells Frodo, "Always remember, Frodo, the ring is trying to get back to its master. It wants to be found." Power wants to concentrate. And I think it goes back to the fall in the garden. And selfishness coming into the human DNA. So instead of God-conscious, it became self-conscious. Ah, I need clothes, right? And so this selfishness causes Cain to kill Abel. And so you put some babies in a playpen, one of them will take the rattle from the others. You put some kids on a playground, one of them is the bully hogging the ball. Put some natives in the woods, one of them is the Indian chief. Put some people in an inner city, one of them is the gang leader. And all a king is, in a sense, is a glorified gang leader. And it's a patronage system, very hierarchical, where if you are friends with the king, you are more equal. If you are not friends with the king, you are less equal. And if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead, or you're a slave, right? And so it's like a pyramid, right? So the Pharaoh's on top and the slaves are on the bottom. And the law is nothing more than the king's will being forced down the throat of everybody. And so they came up with this way to support it. They called it the divine right of kings. These kings would say, well, the creator chose me to be this divinely appointed intermediary between these common people in heaven. And so the Assyrians, their kings were king priests. And the pharaohs claimed to be son of the god Osiris. And the Roman emperors claimed to be divine. And the Chinese emperors ruled by claiming they had a mandate from heaven. The Incan emperors claimed to be delegates of the sun god, right? And so this idea of God is up here, and then he gives his power to some political leader, and then he dispenses it to the people. And here's Louis XIV, the sun king, who had this global empire that went from Vietnam and Cambodia to Canada. And he says, I am the state. Talk about an ego. And then he says, it is legal because I wish it. Right? It's just the law is his will being forced down the pyramid. And so it took centuries before America was given the chance to break away from the king and do power from the bottom up. So let's jump into some history, and quickly I'll go through. So we got 3 centuries of Christian persecutions. And then Constantine legalizes Christianity, and then you got Attila the Hun conquering, you got some heresies from the inside, but then you have a major attack from Islam. So in 610 AD, Muhammad starts his faith, and he is a religious leader in the pagan city of Mecca. And Muhammad makes 70 converts in 12 years. That's not very many. And so he begins to get frustrated and confrontational. And the people of Mecca, who have been very tolerant, letting him do his new faith, they realize that he's getting exclusive and he's interrupting their pagan worship. And finally, they decide they're going to chase him out of town and for disturbing the peace. So he's chased out of town. He tries to go to a city called Al-Ta'if. They don't want him. They pelt him with rocks and stones. So Muhammad has nowhere to go. He is a Muslim refugee. And so he goes north 210 miles to a Jewish city. And they're nice and tolerant, and they let Muhammad in as a Muslim immigrant. Muhammad goes into the minority neighborhoods in Medina, and he begins to find people with grievances against the Jewish-controlled government, and he begins to organize them, right? We're familiar with the term of organizing in the community. He gets a following. He goes back to the Jewish leaders, and he presents himself as a political leader. And so the Jews make a treaty with Muhammad. And now he's a political leader in addition to being a religious leader. Then something happens. Muhammad's followers in Mecca, they get pushy, argumentative, confrontational, and threatening, the way some of his followers are today. They get chased out of town for disturbing the peace. They are Muslim refugees. They go to Medina, and the Jews are nice. They let them in as Muslim immigrants, sort of like a host country, right? They're a host victim. And so the Muslims come in, and Muhammad allows his followers to rob the caravans headed to Mecca in retaliation for the Meccans chasing them out of town. So where Jesus said, if they take your coat, give them your shirt, Muhammad's attitude was, if they take your house, you retaliate, take their caravan. And so Muhammad had 300 warriors, and they would rob caravans. He got a whole chapter of the Quran from his Allah on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. Muhammad got a fifth of the booty. And so the pagans of Mecca send 1,000 soldiers to protect their caravan, and Muhammad with 300 defeats 1,000 at the Battle of Badr in 624 AD. This amazing victory, having been outnumbered 3-1, convinces Muhammad to be a military leader. And Muhammad fights in 66 battles and raids in the next 8 years before he dies. He even uses the catapult when he attacked the city of Al-Ta'if. And when they told Muhammad this catapult was hurling rocks that were killing women and children, Muhammad's response was, they are among them. So they got to be killed too. So suicide bombers and ISIS killers and San Bernardino and Orlando killers say it's okay to kill innocent people to advance Islam because Muhammad did. And since Muhammad is the perfect Muslim, Muslims that want to be better Muslims, they want to be like him religiously, politically, and militarily. So Islam is a religious system, a political system, and a military system. A mosque is a religious building, a political building, and a military building. Bowing to Mecca is a religious bowing, a political bowing, and a military pledging of allegiance to another capital. And our effort in the West to split the religious side of Islam away from the political military side is we're trying to split Muhammad, Who are we to split their prophet? He was all three. So there's freedom for all religions in America, but Islam is not just a religion because Muhammad was not just a religious leader. Well, within 5 years of Muhammad's death, every Jew in the city of Medina was chased out, killed, or enslaved. And within 5 years of Muhammad's death, every pre-existing culture in Arabia was wiped out. They went from Arabia to Paris in a 100-year military campaign. And since this is Muhammad and the rightly guided caliphs, the ISIS Muslims today look back at them the same way Christians look back at the early church and Jesus and the apostles, right? And so they want to follow that example. Well, Sultan Suleiman controlled all this area that used to be Christian. All right, Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, into the Holy Land and into Syria and Assyria and into Iraq and the Persian Empire and into Turkey and then into all the Eastern European countries, Romania, Bulgaria, and so forth. Well, his counterpart is the Catholic Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V of Spain. And he controls Spain, the Spanish Netherlands, and Italy and Austria, and then the New World and the Philippines are named after his son, King Philip of Spain. And through marriage, he controls these Portuguese areas, the blue on the map. And so these are the two most powerful men in the world, and they're kings. Remember, that's where I started off talking about kings. Okay, so we're still talking about kings, and we got these two most powerful kings. One is Muslim, and the other is Catholic. Well, Charles V decides he's going to strike a deal with the Protestants because they just started the Reformation, and he has a double dilemma. He's got the Protestant Reformation on one hand, Muslim invasion on the other hand. So Charles V does this Treaty of Augsburg of 1555. You may not be familiar with this, but this treaty had an enormous ripple effect all across Europe. Because in this piece of Augsburg of 1555 is a little Latin phrase that made a big difference. The phrase was, cuius regio, ius religio, which means, whose is the reign, his is the religion. In other words, look, Protestant king, believe whatever you want in your kingdom. Let's just work together against these Muslims who are invading Europe because they want to kill us all. And it worked. They stopped the Muslim invasion, but it started a domino effect across Europe in the next century where different kings decided to believe slightly different things. And northern Germany and Sweden were Lutheran, Switzerland Calvinist, Scotland Presbyterian, Holland Dutch Reformed. Greece was Greek Orthodox, Russia was Russian Orthodox, England was Anglican, and Spain, Portugal, France, Austria, Italy, Poland remained Catholic. So prior to the Muslim invasion, all of Western Europe was Catholic. After the Muslim invasion, Charles V let them believe whatever they want, and Europe begins to divide up into all these different denominations, and it was this attitude, what the king believed, the kingdom had to believe. And so it was one Christian denomination per country in Europe. Right? So before the Muslim invasion, it was all Catholic. After the Muslim invasion, Charles V lets them believe different things. And so they're believing different things. But if you did not believe the way your king did, you were persecuted and you fled. And so Europe is thrown into this mass migration of people shifting around simply for conscience sake. And those were the people that spilled over and founded colonies in America. So we're eventually coming to America and how America is under God and how unique we are, but I'm laying the groundwork. Does this make sense to you? So let's look at England. England was Catholic and had a king named Henry VIII. He was married to Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of the King of Spain. And after 18 years, Catherine does not have a son. A daughter married, but not a son. So Henry VIII decides to divorce her. Well, the Pope is not going to recognize the divorce because she is, after all, the daughter of the most powerful guy in the world. And so Henry VIII says, well, you know what? I'll just make myself my own Pope. He starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, and he goes on to have six wives. And their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So Henry VIII was not a really nice guy to be married to. Well, his advisors suggested to him that if he really wanted to go through with breaking with Rome, he should stop using that old Latin Bible and get himself an English Bible. And so Henry VIII spreads this English Bible around Europe for political reasons, thinking it's going to solidify his break with Rome, but something unexpected happened. People began to read it. and began to compare what's in this Bible to this king divorcing and beheading his wife and claiming to be the head of Christ's church on earth. And so a group started that wanted to purify the Church of England, and it was nicknamed the Puritans. Well, the king obviously didn't think he needed any purifying, so he persecuted this group and hired an Anglican archbishop under James I and then Charles I, and they would send spies into the churches and listen to the pastor's sermons. And if they didn't line up with the Anglican liturgy, the pastor was arrested. Sort of reminds you of Houston, where the mayor wants to get all the sermons of the pastors, right? And there was a Puritan professor at, I think, Cambridge named Alexander Layton. And he thought that the Anglicans should have separated more from the Catholic Church. Well, he was arrested. His issue was on the cassocks. He thought they shouldn't be wearing the cassocks anymore. But he was arrested and ordered to have his nose cut in half, his ears cut off, branded on the face as a heretic, whipped twice, and put in the Tower of London until he died. It was a serious thing for not believing the way your king did. Well, there was another group that said it's beyond hope of trying to purify the Church of England. We are going to separate ourselves. And they would meet in secret, in barns and basements by candlelight. And they decided they were going to flee to Holland. And they eventually do. And we call them the Pilgrims. So they're in Holland for 12 years. And when Spain threatens to attack Holland, they figure it's time to leave again. And they are going to come to Virginia, which was started a few years earlier. And they were going to submit to the law of Virginia. But they got blown off course and they landed in Massachusetts. Well, they didn't. I read through every charter of every colony. And most of them, it's the king deciding who is going to run the colony in his stead. So there's three types of colonies. A company colony with a charter with bylaws and the king gives his approval to it. Or a royal colony where the king has his royal appointed governor that runs it underneath of his authority. Or it's a proprietary colony where the king gives the land to one of his friends. Like Lord Baltimore got all of Maryland. The seven Lord Proprietors got the Carolinas. And they gave Pennsylvania to William Penn. Right? It was his property. But the king is deciding it. He's in charge. Well, these Pilgrims, they get blown off course into Massachusetts. And there's no king-appointed person on their boat. And they say, well, we can't get off the boat and have no law. We got to have something. And so they came up with something called the Mayflower Compact. And there's this revolutionary line in there that's this. In the presence of God, we covenant ourselves together into a civil body politic to enact just and equal laws, as shall be thought most meet, unto which we promise all due submission. This was revolutionary. This was them granting themselves permission to do a government under God and agreeing to follow it. This wasn't the king deciding who's going to be in charge and approving some bylaws. This was them granting themselves permission. And so this became a blueprint for the other New England colonies and eventually Connecticut. And the word federal is Latin for covenant. Our federal government is we the people. We're granting ourselves permission, right? Now, where in the world did the Pilgrims get the idea that they could create a civil body politic, a government? From their pastor. John Robinson pictured there with his hands out, and then there's the elder William Brewster holding an open Bible. And this painting is in our U.S. Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. These Pilgrims got the idea from their separatist pastor, John Robinson, that said, look, when you got a big decision, you all get together and fast and pray and vote. It's not some king appointing an Anglican bishop who appoints an Anglican priest and he comes and tells you what God's will is. No, it's you seeking God individually and then coming together and coming to get to know the Lord's will. Anyway, so I read through every charter of every colony and I found something interesting. Every colony was founded by a different Christian denomination. So you got Europe, you got these Christians being chased all around, they're spilling over and founded colonies. And so Virginia was an Anglican colony from 1606 to 1786. Massachusetts was a Puritan colony. New York was a Dutch Reformed colony. Maryland was originally a Catholic colony. New Jersey was a Swedish Lutheran colony. So was Delaware. Rhode Island was a Baptist colony. Pennsylvania was a Quaker colony. Georgia was a plain Protestant colony. Its original charter in 1732 said all persons except papists shall have a free exercise of their religion. Well, papists, papal, is Catholic. Everybody except Catholics, right? Connecticut was a Congregationalist Christian colony, as was New Hampshire. And the Carolinas were originally the seven Lord proprietors, and it was Anglican, but they wanted to hurry up and populate the colony. So they left a loophole, where the proprietors could, in their discretion, let in non-Anglicans so they could be exposed to the true Anglican faith. Well, what happened was a whole lot of Presbyterians and Puritans and Quakers began to flood into the Carolinas. And then they get a new governor that wants to tighten the screws and make it more Anglican. And that's when South Carolina splits away in 1711 and says, no, we don't want to do that. And so I read, these are some excerpts. Here's Queen Elizabeth's charter to Sir Walter Raleigh, 1584. Laws may not be against the true Christian religion now professed in the Church of England, right? Anglican. The first charter of Virginia, and propagating the Christian religion to such people as yet live in darkness. I thought this was interesting. This is the Virginia Assembly. It meets in the choir loft of the church in Jamestown, Virginia. But this is their government, right? And they're making a decision in their legislature. Listen to this. Whosoever shall absent himself from divine service any Sunday without an allowable excuse shall forfeit a pound of tobacco. And the pastor says, you missed church on Sunday, pay the tobacco. And so in 1705, the Virginia Assembly said this: if a person denies the Christian religion to be true or the scriptures to be of divine authority, he is punishable by incapacity to hold any office. You could not hold office in Virginia unless you were a Christian. And then when it becomes a state in 1776, the Virginia Constitution says it is the mutual duty of all to practice Christian forbearance, love, and charity towards each other. That is still in the Virginia Constitution, Christian forbearance. South Carolina's 1778 state. So I read through every state constitution. Did you know 9 of the original 13 state constitutions required you to be a Protestant Christian to hold state office? And so we see that 3 of them, you had to be a plain Christian, and then 1 had no religious requirements. But let me go through some of these. And so the book, Original 13, thank you, Jerry, I go through and I actually take excerpts out of every single charter, out of every single colony, and then every state constitution and every revision and amendment to every state constitution from the founding of Virginia to today, from the founding of Massachusetts to today. And you realize, like, where does the atheist fit in? They don't. Right? It was Christian. And so what happened was, so here's South Carolina, 1778. The Christian Protestant religion shall be deemed the established religion of this state. I've actually talked to attorneys that said if they wanted America to be a Christian nation, why didn't they just say so in the Constitution? I go, duh, they did. They're state constitutions. Did you read them? The Christian Protestant religion shall be deemed the established religion of this state. I think they established it. New Hampshire's 1784 Constitution. No person shall be capable of being elected who is not of the Protestant religion. That was in effect till 1877. Delaware. Now, 3 states were liberal. And they said all you had to do was be a plain Christian to hold state office. You didn't have to be a Protestant. You could be a plain Christian. This opened the door for Catholics. And so the 3 states were Delaware, Pennsylvania, Maryland. Here's Delaware's Constitution of 1776. Every person appointed to office shall subscribe, I profess faith in God the Father, in Jesus Christ, his only Son, in the Holy Ghost, one God, blessed forevermore. That was really liberal. Think that's liberal? Yeah, because you could be Protestant or Catholic and believe that. Maryland's original state constitution, 1776, said no other test is required than an oath to the state and a declaration of belief in the Christian religion. That was, again, very liberal. Why? Because you could be a Protestant or a Catholic. Now, in 1851, there was a persecution of Jews in Bavaria, and they came across, and so Maryland added, again, the date, 1851, they added this bottom part there. See that? And if the party shall profess to be a Jew, the declaration shall be of a belief in a future state of rewards and punishments. So as of 1851, a Christian and a Jew could hold office in the state of Maryland. And let's look at Florida while we're at it. Florida's state motto is, in God we trust. And in 1838, Florida became their state constitution. It says, all men have a natural and unalienable right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own conscience. So you don't have a king telling you that you have to believe the way he tells you to. You don't have Sharia law saying that if you don't believe in Allah, you get your head chopped off. Right? So this is this idea that God is a God of love. And he wants you to love him back. But he can't force you, because the moment he forces you, it's not love. Right? Like the husband wants his wife to love him. And if he twists her arm and says, tell me you love me, no matter what she says, she doesn't love him. But if the husband woos her and courts her and gives her roses and candy and treats her really nice, then she all of a sudden, out of the abundance of her heart, says, oh, I love you. Then it means something. That's what God's after. He's not in submit to me or I chop your head off. He's interested in this mystical thing of you voluntarily submitting your will to him. Anyway, so he has positive and negative motivations. The positive is he blesses us so much we turn to him out of gratefulness. If that doesn't work, there's plan B. He withholds the blessings and we turn to him out of desperation. So like to bring the horse to the water, he can't make it drink. So he wants us to turn to him, but he can't force us, right? Now he does give us the grace to turn to him, but we have to go along with it. Anyway, so here's the 1885 Florida Constitution. We, the people of the state of Florida, grateful to Almighty God. It's singular. It's not gods. We're not talking Buddhism or Hinduism. And then in 1885, it says, liberty of conscience hereby secured shall not be so construed as to justify licentiousness. So in other words, you can't use your freedom of conscience to do sexual immorality, like gay marriage or transgendered or anything, right? So you can't use this freedom of religion to try to, and the country faced that with the Mormons. Right? In the 1800s in Utah, they says, hey, our religion says we can have 19 wives. And we says, ah, we're not buying it. All right? You can't do sexual immorality and say it's part of your religion. Well, let's focus on New England. And we're talking about kings. We're talking about how unique America is. We're talking about how it started off with all these kings and pharaohs and Caesars and Kaisers. And then you got the Roman emperor. And then you got the Attila the Hun. And then the Muslims come in. And then the Muslims are conquering. You got the two most powerful kings, King Charles V, the Muslim Sultan. And then you got the Charles V striking a deal, letting the Protestants have their kingdoms. And then the Protestants don't get along. They chase each other out. They spill over and found colonies. So we're getting close to America. Let's look at New England. This is where the real experiment took place. In New England, it was founded by pastors and their churches. So you have a Reverend John Cotton and his church founded Boston. Reverend John Lothrop and his church founded Barnstable, Massachusetts. Reverend Roger Williams and his church founded Providence, Rhode Island. Reverend John Wheelwright and his church founded Exeter, New Hampshire. Reverend Thomas Hooker and his church founded Hartford, Connecticut. Right? So most of these landed in Massachusetts, and the Puritans are unique because in England, they did not like the king sending spies into their churches and telling them how to believe. But once the Puritans came to America in such large numbers, they realized they were the government. And so maybe it's not such a bad thing that the government tells the church how to have church. And so some of these pastors, like Thomas Hooker, says, okay, everybody, we don't go along with this Puritan teaching so much. So every next Saturday, we're all going to meet in the church parking lot. And we're going to get our wagons and our oxen, and we're going to go hill and dale, find a nice spot, make friends with the Indians, chop down trees, and they will start a community. And then the people come to the pastor, Thomas Hooker, and they say, Pastor, how do we do the government thing? And so Thomas Hooker gives a sermon in 1638 to tell them how to do the government thing. And he has a revolutionary line, the foundation of authority is laid firstly in the free consent of the people. This was revolutionary, as most of the world at the time was ruled by kings and emperors and czars and chieftains. So he's saying it's the people from the bottom up rather than king forcing his will from the top down. And so Thomas Hooker's sermon became the basis for the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut. A pastor's sermon became the government charter. And the historian John Fisk said that it comprised the first written constitution in history. It became a blueprint for the other New England colonies and eventually the U.S. Constitution. So Connecticut is called the Constitution State, and Thomas Hooker's statue is displayed at Connecticut's capital in Hartford. A pastor's statue is on the state capitol grounds. He's holding his Bible. It was his sermon that became the government for the colony. And when Connecticut broke away from England during the Revolution, other states were scrapping their charters and coming up with state constitutions. Connecticut said, no, our state constitution is working just fine. They continued to use it up until 1818. The pastor's sermon became the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut that was the state government up until 1818. So instead of separation of church and state, in New England, it was the pastors that created the state. Can you see it? So here they're saying, oh, separate pastors aren't supposed to be involved in government. Well, wait a second. New England, the pastor created the government. And so Calvin Coolidge said in 1926, the principles which went into the Declaration of Independence are found in the sermons of the early colonial clergy. They preached equality because they believed in the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. In order that they might have freedom to express these thoughts and opportunities to put them into action, whole congregations with their pastors migrated to the colonies. So the pastors and their churches came over and would start communities. Now, the pastors during the colonial era had two main views. One was the Calvinist Puritan view that said God has a plan for your life, your marriage, your family, your church, and your government. Figure out what that plan is and put it into place. Simple. There was another view that pastors had called Pietism. What was that? Remember Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses and started the Reformation? Why? Because he had a personal revelation that the just shall live by faith. Well, some princes in Germany wanted to break away from Rome. And so they said, kingdom of mine, you are all now Lutheran. If you don't like it, leave. And so the people said, okay, we're Lutheran. What do we believe again? So for the people in those kingdoms, it was not necessarily the same personal experience that Martin Luther had. It was just agreeing with the state doctrine. And so a revival movement started in Germany called Pietism that said it's more than just believing doctrine, as good as it is. You have to have a personal experience with Jesus. And when you do, your life should change. And you'll no longer do those worldly things that you used to do, like going to bars and brothels and theaters and lewd things and get involved in worldly things like government. Wait, what was that last thing? Yeah, you see everybody involved in government, they're all worldly. And so if you're really a Christian, you're not going to get involved in government. It was the beginning of this, oh, let's not get involved in government mentality, right? And so these two threads go back. One says God's got a plan for the government, put it in place. The other says, oh, it's dirty, don't get involved. Now this comparison is best illustrated by two brothers. Their dad started the Lutheran Church in America, who was friends with Count Ludwig von Zinzendorf, but the dad was Henry Muhlenberg. He's in Pennsylvania. He's got two sons, John Peter and Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg. They're both Pietist pastors. And John Peter's in Woodstock, Virginia, and he goes and hears Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty, Give Me Death speech. He is so inspired, he goes to George Washington and says, I want to help. Washington said, fine, you are now a colonel. Go get your men. So he goes back to his church. He gives a sermon on Ecclesiastes, a time for all things, time to gather stones, time to scatter stones, time to preach, and a time to fight. And he takes off his clerical robe, and underneath he has the uniform of a continental officer. And he has an altar call, and the men of his church come forward, and some of the surrounding churches, and they get about 300 men together. They kiss their wives goodbye, and they go off to become the 8th Virginia Regiment. They fight in lots of battles. He gets promoted to major general, and after the war, he is elected congressman in the very first session of Congress, where they passed the First Amendment. Well, his brother, Frederick Muhlenberg, is pastoring in New York, and he's writing letters to John Peter saying, you have become too involved in matters which, as a preacher, you have nothing whatsoever to do. Saying, you shouldn't be involved in government. And John Peter accuses Frederick of being a Tory British sympathizer. And Frederick writes back, says he could not serve two masters. And these brothers are going at it until the British invade New York. They burn Frederick's church. His wife and kids have to flee the city. And Frederick says, maybe we should get involved. He ends up getting elected to Congress, and he is the first Speaker of the House. The first Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives is Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg. And what got passed under him being the Speaker? The First Amendment, the Bill of Rights. There's two signatures on the Bill of Rights. John Adams as the President of the Senate and Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg. Does anybody honestly think that these two pastors would vote to outlaw themselves? Would they vote to say, people of faith should not get involved in government, even though we are people of faith and we are involved in government? No, the First Amendment means what it says. It ties the federal government's hands. Congress shall make no law. Who does that limit? I think Congress. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, if they would have seen ahead that the Supreme Court would make laws from the bench, They would have said, Congress and the Supreme Court shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. And if they would have saw ahead and see that the president would make laws through executive orders and through regulations, they would have said, Congress, the Supreme Court, and the president shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Religion was under state's jurisdiction. Anyway, so in New England, they realized that the kingdom of God could never be forced from the top down. They saw these kings in Europe burning people at the stake if they didn't believe the way the king did. And they said, look, Jesus never forced anyone to believe in him. Jesus said something difficult. Many disciples walked with him no more. Jesus didn't run after him with a sword and try to chop their head off. He turns to Peter and says, you want to go too? There's the door. Peter said, well, where else can we go? You're the only one with the words of eternal life. Jesus was willing to let them go. Why? Because he cared about their free, their conscience, their voluntary decision. So if Jesus didn't force anybody to believe, we, these pastors in America and these governments that they're started, doesn't want to force people to believe. So it came up with this liberty of conscience idea. Well, in New England, they realized the kingdom of God could never be forced from the top down. But wait a second, how's it going to happen? They thought if the majority of the people held godly values and elected representatives with their values, then laws would be passed reflecting those values, and the values of the kingdom could come from the bottom up, not forced from the top down. Can you see it? And so here's the comparison. Does power flow from the creator to the king and he dispenses it top down to the people? Or does power flow from the creator directly to the people and they choose their leaders from amongst themselves? That is why the revolutionary statement in the Declaration, all men are endowed by their creator. It's not the creator gives the rights to the kings and he endows it. No, we get it directly. We bypass the king. And so where in the world did the pastor get the idea for this, of the creator giving the rights to the people? Lo and behold, they did look to England and the limitations on a king with the Magna Carta. They did look to the Roman Republic, which went on for 500 years until Julius Caesar found a way to make himself dictator for life. They did look to the Athenian democracy, which lasted until Alexander the Great had conquered him. But ultimately, they looked back to Israel. That's right, Israel. Did you know after the Constitution was written, it had to go to the states to be ratified? They needed 9 states. They had 8. New Hampshire was in line to be the 9th, but it was in a deadlock at their ratifying convention. And so Harvard President Samuel Langdon gave an address in 1788 titled The Republic of the Israelites, an Example to the American States. They hear the address, they ratify it, they are the 9th state. The U.S. Constitution goes into effect after this sermon. What was the Republic of the Israelites? Well, around 1400 B.C., Israel comes out of Egypt, and they go into the Promised Land. And for the first 400 years, Israel did not have a king. Everyone was equal before the law. The whole world is kings and pharaohs and emperors and Caesars, and they come out of slavery for 400 years, and they have this the most unique form of government that flips it, and there's no king. Everyone was equal before the law, male, female, made in the image of the Creator. Even the stranger living amongst you is under the same law that you're under. This is the beginning of the concept of equality on planet Earth. There's no royal family. Everyone you see is equal to you. There's no king to butter up next to. Israel is the first nation with private land ownership. You see, wherever there's a king, you never really own the land. It's always conditional of you staying on the nice side of the king. You cross the king, he will take away the land and kill you. Well, in Israel, the land was permanently titled to the families. If they got in a pinch and sold it, every 50 years it reverted back to the family. This prevented a dictator from gathering up the land and putting the people back into slavery. And so that's why they call it the Promised Land. And so if you can control land, you can accumulate stuff. The Bible called that being blessed. Karl Marx called it being a capitalist. You got capital, so you worked hard, saved it. Israel was the first nation with no police because everyone was taught the law, everyone enforced the law. It was sort of like everyone was deputized. We still do that today. You know, somebody makes a wrong turn in the traffic and the person in the next car over shakes his finger at him. Israel had no standing army. You have a king, he has an army to enforce his will. In Israel, every man was in the militia and armed and ready at a moment's notice to defend his family and his community. Israel had no prisons. Remember Joseph wasting away in the prison in Egypt? In Israel, the law says immediate justice at the gate of the city. You get the elders together, you hear the case and decide it right then. And then a city of refuge you could run away to await a trial. Israel had a bureaucracy-free welfare system. So it's not like Egypt where you sold your soul to the Pharaoh for a handout of grain. In Israel, when someone harvested their field, they left the gleanings for the poor people to pick through. This way, the poor were taken care of without some political leader collecting everything and doling it back out to those who can help them stay in power. Israel had a system of honesty that became the basis for commerce. God hates unjust weights and measures. And Israel got to choose their own leaders from the bottom up. What do we mean? Deuteronomy 1, Moses spake unto the children of Israel, how can I myself alone bear your burden? Take you wise men and understanding and known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. So Moses didn't go out among 3 million people and say, you're the leaders. No, he said, take you wise men. It's an election process. In your tribe, you find the people who are responsible, fear God, hate covetousness, you know, able men, love the truth, and you bring them to me, and I'll recognize them as your leaders. So Israel was very decentralized, but it had maximum individual liberty and freedom. Anybody could be raised up in leadership. Gideon, look at Deborah. A woman becomes a leader in Israel. Not because she's related to the Pharaoh or the emperor, but simply because she knows the law and she's honest. And people make their way all the way across the country. She sits under a tree, she hears their cases and decides it. Where else in the world could a woman become a leader simply by her own merits of knowing the law and being honest? And this is really interesting. Israel is the first nation that could read. That's right. In Sumeria, they had 1,500 cuneiform characters. I don't know about you, but memorizing 1,500 anything is pretty complicated. And it was just for court records. The first invention was the plow. You know, Cain, tiller of the soil. And then people started hitting each other with it, right? Cain kills Abel. And so people would gravitate together into cities for protection. And when you get people together, someone ends up being the one to tell everybody else what to do. And at first it's good, you defend yourselves, but then that person has kids and grandkids who claim to be this elite class. My genealogy goes back to the guy that founded this whole place, and I'm more special. And then it turns into this hereditary monarchy where you got this elite class, and this king says, I'm divinely appointed, and I own everything. And the king would keep track of the stars and decrees and then everything. And so the first writing was an accounting method. So in China, they would have warehouses with knots in ropes. That's how they'd keep track. And they would have the scribes would keep the court records. And the abacus with rods and little beads would slide back and forth. And so in Sumeria, they had tokens and dishes. A warehouse, little dishes with tokens. That's how they would know how much is in there. Then they would make markings in the tokens. Again, like tallying, where you do the lines 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And then it turned into all these other things. But they had 1,500 cuneiform characters just for the kings and their scribes. Egypt had 3,000 hieroglyphic characters. Again, just for the pharaohs and their scribes. China had 10,000 pictogram characters. It was just court records. Only the upper class could read. Uneducated people were easier to control. Sort of like in Virginia and Maryland prior to the Civil War. They had laws making it a crime to teach slaves to read. Here's Frederick Douglass, a Republican advisor to Lincoln, talks about growing up on a plantation. The slave master's sister-in-law was teaching him the alphabet. Slave master walks in and yells at her, don't you dare teach slaves to read. They'll grow discontent and run away. And so if you want to control people, you want to keep them ignorant. Sort of have them going through a common core where they go through the motions of learning, but it's all just behavior modification. You really don't want them to academically achieve. Anyway, when Moses came down the mountain, he did not just have the law. He had the law in a 22-character alphabet that was so easy to learn, the entire nation became literate. Israel is the first instance in world history where everyone could read. And not only could they read, they were required to read because the law was addressed to each person. So the priests and the Levites would take the young kids and they have the little pointer and they take them through and show them all the little letters. And so Margaret Thatcher says the Decalogue, Ten Commandments, are the origin of the sanctity of the individual. You don't get that in any other political creed. It's personal liberty with personal responsibility. And so it's a spectrum of power. One side's total government and the other side's no government. So everybody hold up a fist in one hand and say concentrated power. Concentrated power. Then your fingers open with the other hand, say separated power, separated power. Then back to the fist, concentrated power, concentrated power. That is world history. For most of world history, power is in the hands of the kings, pharaoh, Caesar, Kaiser, sultans, and czars. Every now and then, beginning with Israel, people get a rare opportunity to stretch the rubber band and rule themselves without a king. But in times of domestic crises and external attack, the rubber band snaps back into the hands of a king. And so, Lord Acton says, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Let's say you got to be the king, and you were going to be really fair. And then you have a sister with a teenage son that drinks and drives and hits somebody and kills him. And now this teenager's facing life imprisonment, manslaughter charges, and your sister comes begging to you and says, you're not going to let my little Johnny get locked away the rest of his life. It wasn't his fault. Those other kids talked him into it, blah, blah, blah. What are you going to say to your sister? Well, I'll let little Johnny off the hook this time, but don't let it happen again. Guess what? As soon as you say that, you are the corrupt dictator. You just sent ripples through your kingdom. That if you're family or friends of the king, you get special treatment. And if you're not family and friends, you don't get that. And if you're an enemy, they're going to be tempted to want to shut you up. And so, for a people to rule themselves without a king, the people need morals and virtues. Sort of like the parent gives the teenager the car keys again and says, you can come home whenever because I know you're going to do what's right. You have these internal morals. But if you don't do what's right, you're going to be locked behind bars. So in other words, teenager, you're going to be controlled either voluntarily from the inside or forcibly from the outside. It's the same way with a country. We're either going to be voluntarily controlled within individual morals or we're going to give in to our passions and lusts and have chaos and then beg for a strong leader. And so in Israel's case, they had these internal morals called the law. But wait a second. Why would you follow an internal moral? What would cause you to want to deny a selfish tendency? Israel had the important ingredient. A God who is watching everyone. He wants you to be fair. And he will hold you accountable in the future. So you're about to steal something. And you know you can get away with it. And then you think, God is watching. He wants me to be fair. He's going to hold me accountable. Maybe I should hesitate stealing. And it creates something in your head called a conscience. If everybody in the country believes God is watching, he wants me to be fair, he's going to hold me accountable, everybody is motivated to follow these internal morals, and you can have complete order in society with no policemen following everybody around. Maximum individual liberty and freedom. Now, it only works with the God of the Bible. An Islamic Allah God says there's an infidel woman there, you can rape or steal from this infidel. It's only the God of the Bible says do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So, I think I'm running out of time. But here's a great quote from Democrat candidate for president in 1908, William Jennings Bryan. A religion which teaches personal responsibility to God gives strength to morality. There is a powerful restraining influence in the belief that an all-seeing eye scrutinizes every thought and word and act of the individual, which comes with the conscious presence of a personal God. And let me go past these for the sake of time. But you get rid of this God, then you just have morals. Why follow him? Some will, some won't. But the ones that won't are going to start saying, there's no God, this life is all there is. What's wrong with stealing and lying and committing adultery and smashing windows and setting buildings on fire and having mobs in the street and random killings of police officers? And then everybody's going to say, government, please come in and restore order with a strong arm. And they'll come in and they'll take over the local police departments with a strong cities initiative. And everybody's going to be thanking them. But when the dust settles, you'll have realized you fundamentally transformed your form of government from the people ruling themselves back to a king. And so our form of God. So what happened with Israel? It worked as long as the priest taught the law. When the priest stopped teaching the law, every man did what was right in their own eyes, right? Eli's own son sleeping with women in the tent of meeting. Tribe of Dan, a Levite has a graven image, which was breaking the law. And then the Levite with a concubine. The law says the Levite's to marry a virgin of his own tribe. And the concubine's raped. He chops her body in 12 pieces. They send it to the 12 tribes. They get together to kill the Sodomites. And by the time you're grossed out, you read this line that says every man did what was right in their own eyes. Why did they all do what was right in their own eyes? Because the priests had stopped teaching them what was right in the Lord's eyes. So they had all this chaos. And they end up going to Samuel. And they say, we want to be like all the other countries. We want a king. Samuel cries. And the Lord tells him, they have not rejected thee. They have rejected me. That I should not reign over them. So God says, you want a king? I'll give you a king. King Saul. What did he do? Saul turns around and kills most of the priests, right? Had Doeg the Edomite stab them all. And so Yale President Ezra Stiles says, the secular welfare of God's ancient people depended upon their virtue, their religion, their observance of that holy covenant which Israel entered into with God. Well, there's a whole lot more, but I'm going to respect the time. All the information is in my books on the table. And I want to end with this one thought. It's in times of crises that power concentrates into the hands of a king. But it's in times of crises that people turn to Christ. So the same crises that the devil wants to use to go back to reassembling a Nimrod, right? God is going to cause a great revival. And people are going to realize that God, out of these 6,000 years of world history, God chose you to be alive right now. And God, what are the stories we love most in the Bible? It's where God's people are in a hopeless situation. And God raises up little nobodies with faith and courage to stand up, and God uses them to deliver his people, right? And so it's not ability, it's availability. You make yourself available, God will add the ability. So God loves to use little nobodies to do great things from the bottom up, not forced from the top down. And so this is your opportunity. I'm going to end with that. God bless you. Thank you so much. All right.